TNKR Media.
Welcome to Inspiring Entrepreneurs, our 15th season, showcasing stories from outstanding business people, presented by BDO Canada. My name is Dan Delmar, along with Mike Newton of BDO, our second to last show of the season. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Dan, how are you? Yeah, the season's coming to an end. It's been a lot of fun.
Really, really fantastic season. And I guess we can just jump right in and talk about not only who's on the show today, but who our big finale guest is. So today we're talking with someone who's really focused on fashion, François Thériault, the co-founder of Sur Mesure. They do custom tailored suits, and they have this really interesting website, online interface, and it's all kind of streamlining the tailored suit experience. And we'll get to suits in a second, Mike, but first let's talk about who's going to be on the big finale. Do you want to do the big reveal?
No, Dan, I'm going to leave it to you. You're the real broadcaster, so you go ahead.
Oh, thanks. I'm going to lean into my mic here and go, Ricardo. Yeah, Ricardo is our Inspiring Entrepreneur finale next week. So Ricardo LaRiviere, you know him from the Ricardo brand, and he's been on CJD many times, of course. Started off as a broadcaster and a technician at CBC and somehow built an empire out of that. It's really a remarkable story. So Ricardo joins us next week on the finale. But this week we're talking suits and manufacturing, Mike. And I'm wondering, you have some thoughts, especially during the pandemic. You know, we've all kind of lost our sense of fashion a little bit. We've all gone a little bit more casual. On Fridays at TNKR, it's basically always casual Fridays. Is that a bad thing? Have we lost our sense of style?
I don't mind casual Fridays. I just have a problem with casual Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, that's then followed by casual Friday. And this continues to be, I think it obviously depends on the industry that you're in and the business that you run and the expectation of your customers and your clients. You know, I'll never forget, I think I was 6 years old. I was walking off the baseball field, and my father looked at me. I had my shirt untucked, and my father looked at me, and he said, "Tuck your shirt in, son." He says, "If you're going to play the part, look the part." And, you know, and that, you know, funny enough, never left me. And I think part of what's happened, and certainly COVID perspective, where we were lucky, I think, some days that people put pants on to come onto the screen, the reality is we've gotten significantly more casual. Now, that's not to say we weren't casual before COVID, so let's not blame this on COVID. I think what it's done is it's perpetuated. And we lost a sense of style. Yeah, I think there's an awful lot of really good casual clothes out there, including casual suits and sport coats and a whole bunch of other things where you can still dress the part. I think what we've lost is a sense of class to a certain degree. And I think if you're going to play in a certain space with the clients and with people, that you need to look the part. And I think there's a certain expectation. And you know, it's not about, I hate to say this because it's going to sound really bad, but it's not about how you feel. It's about what the client expects at the end of the day. And you know, I'll tell you that yes, after 35 years, I'm an old fogey when it comes to dress, and you'll never see me leave my office to go downstairs to get lunch or a coffee without a sport coat or a suit jacket on, because that's the way I was brought up. I'm not saying everybody needs to do that, but what I am saying is, you know, there you're going to run into clients, you're going to run into people, and you know, I might as well just put a baseball cap on backwards, and I couldn't look any worse than some of the people that have come to offices.
We to lift the veil about how we record the show, because I'm a good Jewish boy, we do tape the show on Fridays, Friday mornings, and so Friday is casual Fridays, and I do wear a hoodie. I'm currently wearing a hoodie. Is this unprofessional? Is it destabilizing to be in a Zoom meeting with someone wearing a hoodie?
Again, I think it's really about who your audience is and who's the people in front of you. I mean, it doesn't bother me. I mean, you'll never see me that not with my cufflinks and my French cuff shirts on. And even during COVID, when I worked from home, I had to put them on, because to me, it was about the uniform. It was about the way I felt. It was about a way of confidence. I think you have to take into account, are you going to offend the other person or the people that you're talking to? And I think that's, you know, that's really the part. Reality is, Dan, you're not going to offend me with a hoodie on. Doesn't matter what day it is. But I got to tell you, if I was taking you out to go meet a client on a Friday and you came in a hoodie, I might not be too impressed.
Oh, totally fair. I would never, you know, meeting people in person at an event, plus every day, Monday to Thursday, it's a collared shirt for me. And even if you're remote, I think it's super important to get up every day and do the process and get dressed and look nice. But I also like casual Fridays.
I do. There is a byproduct of that, though, that people don't realize is we become significantly more complacent, and the days that we dressed casual, and this is, I used to see this in Casual Fridays, is people would make an effort, this is obviously before COVID, when people actually left the office to go somewhere or came to the office. During the week, if you were well-dressed and somebody called and said, hey, can you come to our office? Can you come to the bank? Can you go to a client? You hopped in your car and you went because you're already dressed. Fridays, you didn't plan meetings or you didn't quite accept that and say, hey, I'll be there on Monday. Why? Because you didn't look the part. So now what happens is there's very little mobility that goes on. If you're coming in casual and somebody says, hey, come and meet me, you're not going to go if you're dressed casual on a Tuesday because you just don't feel the part. And unfortunately, I think what that does is it takes away from the service or the product that you're offering.
Yeah, totally agree there. And we'll talk a bit about fashion and confidence with François Thériault, co-founder of Sur Mesure, and the manufacturing end as well on the program. Our BDO specialist is Youssef Boutros, partner assurance at BDO Canada, on how to set up manufacturing. Do you go domestic or abroad? And all those details on the way on the program as well. But first, some quick thought leadership. And one note I want to get out of the way about, we were doing some analysis a few weeks ago about the new sign laws. And, you know, opinions aside, you know, we are hearing some entrepreneurs who are facing changes, and they have to discuss signage, commercial signage, what to do. And so an update on that. And so one client is telling me that the OQLF is asking them to plan ahead for 2025 when those English proper names might have to be shrunk a little bit on signage. So the example the government gives on their graphic, remember the Cool Kids example, the Vêtements Cool Kids? So if Cool Kids is the brand name, Vêtements will have to be larger because Cool Kids is an Anglophone proper name. So that's the situation there. And it's just according to the graphic. And so they're going to start enforcing that according to the OQLF in 2025, meaning that if you are redoing your signs or looking at new signage, you may want to consider, as we mentioned, that visual prominence, a greater visual impact is what they call it, for French than other languages on the sign. So Mike, politics aside, there's just a very, very logistical compliance issue here. People have to put signs up and to have them remade. And it's best to speak with a BDO advisor or your lawyer or someone who specializes in these trademark issues.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you have to look at this. I mean, there's two sides, right? There's the politics and the emotional feel to it, but there's also an economic side to this. So realistically, if you know you're going to have to change your signs for 2025 and you're going out to order signs now, I guess you need to be looking ahead and how you want to plan for all of that. So yeah, there is a compliance element to this, an economic element to it. And unfortunately, for as much as the emotional component may play for a lot of people, you have to look at where you're going to be on side with a lot of things.
Another story here from Harvard Business Review. Highly skilled professionals want your work, but not your job. So this article is about freelancing and freelancers being in huge demand. At our shop, we, of course, have a large amount of freelancers, as all marketers do. What are some of the things to consider and some of the issues or pitfalls even in having a large amount of freelancers on staff?
I think the things that we have to watch for, are the same elements that you would watch for if they were full-time employees. They just take on a different flavor, a different color. I mean, you're going to have to continue to manage these people. And sometimes that's even a trickier job because you don't really have the same accountability. As an employee, there's an accountability, there's a direct line of control. Here's your job description. From a freelancer, you're usually on a project basis or you're on some kind of term basis. So you don't quite have the same control over that individual. Again, managing the quality is sometimes can be very different. You get into this deeper remote on-site. I mean, it's harder to take somebody per diem basis and tell them they have to be in the office. They may be working for three or four other people. So, and to me, the big issue really at the end of the day is confidentiality, is how do you maintain the sense that, especially if you're working in an environment, whether it's a law firm or an accounting firm or marketing, where, you know, there are some trade secrets that are going on and somebody's working for five different entities at the same time. Some of them may even be in a similar business. And how do you make sure that they control what's coming out of their mouth and not giving away some of the trade secrets? The problems are no different than the ones we've learned to tackle from employees. Now we just have to extend that into a more robust, likely much you know, a more advantageous environment, because for the bad, there's also the good. The good is, from an employer perspective, they're not on payroll. You know, the good and the bad, the ugly of having to fire somebody, to have to worry about ending an employment is basically on a contract. And I think there's, you know, everybody loves the term engagement. I think there are some negative that comes from the term engagement, which in oftentimes is comfort and complacency. I'm happy where I am. I'm comfortable where I am. Therefore, I'm engaged. Doesn't necessarily mean you're motivated. You know, you can replace that. And probably the biggest is the ability to get your hands on immediately upgraded talent. That is sometimes hard with an employee that's been with you for a long time.
I've had really great luck with freelancers. A lot are my friends, a lot I know from media circles, but you do need a structure. And so I always generally view my freelancers as being in two different streams. Ones that have their own gigs, that want to do their own thing and just want a little contract on the side, great. And then the others are ones that potentially want to be a part of the organization. And we have different strategies for both.
Agreed. It's the pendulum swing, right? I mean, when they work for you, you have more or less utter control. When they don't work for you, you don't. So, but at the same token, you don't want to make the ability to work with you that onerous. I mean, go back to a comment I've said over and over again. I was taught that, you know, make it easy for people to do business with you. Well, that includes the people working with you, you know, so you don't want to make people jump through hoops to come on for freelance if you need them for a project for 2 months. And unfortunately, I think that's what happens, is we try to cross all the T's and dot all of the I's, similar to an employment environment, manage them the same way, and we end up turning them off.
I do use the word asynchronous when we discuss terms often with freelance employees. If you want to go there, I know you don't love the word.
at this point, maybe that's one of the best ways to proceed. So maybe I'll put that into the vocabulary.
Excellent. Okay. Well, maybe that'll be for season 16.
There you go.
We'll work on asynchronous mic. Lastly, we have to get to this funny story. The Onion has been sold, but there's a really interesting satirical twist, of course.
For those of you that don't know The Onion and don't follow, I find we take ourselves in the media sometimes a little too seriously. And I'm a big fan of political satire. And The Onion, GL Media, has agreed to sell to a new Chicago-based firm called Global Tetrahedron.
So the entity acquiring The Onion took their name from an Onion work that parodied sort of venture capital, if I understand.
Correct. It was written by one of the writers a few years ago from the Onion.
Art imitating life. Let's talk about the art of dressing yourself, sur mesure, and François Thériault on the way on Inspiring Entrepreneurs. And for a podcast audience, Mike, maybe we'll chat a little bit more about a reaction that you've heard to capital gains increases in the federal budget. Mike, what have you been hearing over the last week or so following the federal budget?
Panic, anxiety, sleepless nights for a lot of tax practitioners. It's been chaos, because I think the issue at this point is we don't even really know how it's going to be applied. I mean, they've thrown it out there. They've set a deadline of June 25th in order to exercise whatever you're going to do, if you're going to trigger a gain. But it's brought up a whole slew of questions that really nobody has an answer to yet. So, you know, in some cases, for those people that may be a little bit older, if you go back to capital gains exemptions and when you're allowed to bump up in 1981 V-Day values and everything else, there was a point in time where you could bump up your value, take advantage of it, even though you didn't sell. So now one of the questions that's being posed is, well, can I bump up my value before June 25th? Take advantage of a 50% inclusion rate, knowing full well that I'm going to have to pay the tax. However, I've included it at 50 instead of 66 and two-thirds. Well, I mean, we don't know yet. And the interesting component to this is you're not going to do that with something you're going to hold for another 10 years. Why would you prepay tax now for something that you may only sell in 10 years? But if you were going to sell an asset in the next year and you know you were going to have to pay the tax anyways, well, that consideration is certainly out there. And it's one of those things that, you know, people are searching for ideas as they start to address how they want to start tax planning. I think the reality is for those that are affected by stock market gains, we're going to see an awful lot of those being sold, because there is no way that anybody is going to take that one back before June 25th. I think that's going to be the case. The issue that you're going to have is, and the big one, and it's all over the news, is, you know, the family has one asset under their family home, and that's a cottage that's been in the family for 50 years. You know, it was handed down from one generation to the next. The cost was, you know, $5,000, $10,000 when it was built in the 1950s or 1960s or even earlier. Now all of a sudden it's worth $300,000-$500,000. And somebody's going to have to pay the tax on it. Is that a fair? I mean, if we're trying to make the world a fair place, that certainly doesn't sound like a fair place for the average Canadian.
Back to real estate. And, you know, speaking of cottage country, some of the earlier reaction has been from real estate people in cottage country saying that, okay, we're seeing immediately people are starting to move their properties and move their cottages and all of that. And right now I'm coming to you from what was once a cottage in the Laurentians. And so we converted it into a family home in my studio downstairs here. And this is going to be a trend, I think, going forward as people sort of leave the city. Is that part of the plan here? Does the government want, do you think, a bit of movement in real estate to happen?
If you're looking for an honest opinion, no. They're looking for a cash grab. And I think that is to fund the coffers for various plans. And you can say that that's not a bad thing to cash grab. I mean, ultimately, what we're going to do with the money, the whole discussion of tax to me is not whether you agree with tax or not agree with tax. It's what you do with the money at the end of the day. And I can say the same thing here. It's not whether the idea of trying to raise more money is a good thing or a bad thing. It's how it's being executed. And, you know, the only time that tax should be the basis to drive your decision is if you've bought it or you held something initially for a tax purpose. You had a tax shelter, you had something at the end of the day, then you consider the tax and the gain. But a family residence that you've had for 50, 75 years, I'm not going to rush out and sell it because the tax gain is going to cost me an extra 10% in tax if the family decided that they wanted to keep this in perpetuity. You can't let the horse, you know, be driven by the cart. And unfortunately, I think we need to consider, is it a significant implication? Most definitely. But it's a long-term, short-term discussion. You know, it was very interesting. I watched last week's question period. And, you know, they were the Conservatives had someone on, and the NDP had someone on. And, of course, everybody was bashing the budget because that's just what you do in politics. Even if you agree with it, you bash it, right? Because that's just what we do. And the moderator turned to the Conservative representative and said, are you telling us then that if the Conservatives get in, you're going to reverse the capital gains that the Liberals are putting out? Well, we haven't quite analyzed the entire budget yet. We haven't taken opinion. So, you know, at this point, who knows what's going to happen? And I don't want people, you know, jumping off of the ledges at this point until such time as we know what it's going to look like. My concern is we may not find out for another 3 or 4 weeks, which means you're going to have a really short period of time to execute. And the big hits are going to be those significant sales that were coming up that are going to happen later in the year. Can you get them pushed in before June 25th? Or are they going to allow it? I don't know. We don't know how they're going to treat it.
So to recap, for those that had an asset, a cottage or otherwise to sell, you know, in the short term, talk to your advisor. If you were going to hang on to it for 5-10 years, don't even bother to get aggravated right now.
See, I've even got you flustered.
Lastly, I wanted to mention interest rates as well. So the latest analysis suggests that May seems like we're holding. Maybe there's going to be some movement downward in June. What do you think?
Yeah, this has been a bit of a disappointment from an economic standpoint. The inflation numbers and where we are skewed, I think, based on gas, based on food prices. I don't think the economy is doing as well as the numbers indicate. And I think the interest rates are being held because the inflationary numbers are right on that cusp of being dangerous still. And if we put too much influence and too much impetus back into the market, maybe we drive inflation back up again. So I certainly understand where the thought is coming from. It's disappointing because I think for a lot of people right now, They were in a holding pattern while interest rates were a little bit too high, and I think there was a big anticipation that end of 23 and certainly into 24 we were going to see a little bit of relief, and that relief isn't there yet. And you know, when you talk about the price of housing and you talk about the costs associated, and whether that's rental properties or whether that's buying a home, interest rates have a direct impact on not only the cost but the maintenance of these areas. And it's definitely something that's hitting an awful lot of people hard. So, you know, we go back into the whole fairness debate. We could take this topic in many different directions, Dan, and I'm not sure where we're going to land. But I don't see immediacy of interest rates, you know, in the next month or two really starting to creep down. If we see it by the end of the year, I think we'll consider ourselves lucky.
Okay, we'll have a pretty action-packed season finale next week. A lot going on, and Ricardo as well. But for now, let's get to our entrepreneur for this week. His name is François Thériault, co-founder of Sur Mesure. François, welcome to Inspiring Entrepreneurs.
Hey, extremely happy to be on the show. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Thanks for being here. So the first question is the easiest. Tell me, what is Sur Mesure?
Sur Mesure was born in our basement in 2010. It's a made-to-measure concept. So you come to the store, first step, which is the hardest one, select your fabric. We have over, I don't know, maybe 30,000 fabrics. So polka dot, leopard, white, blue, pink, name it. The answer is yes, we have it. It might look fantastic sometimes, not so much, but depends on the customers. Then after that, we have a stylist that kind of guide you through the entire process. We go to every single options for a shirt or for a suit. So everything is menswear at the moment. We're slowly expanding to the women's wear as well. So we're doing a lot of tests, and that's going to be a big part of our future. Third step, now we measure you. So we have a try-on garments, and everybody wants it fit, but the definition of fits according to each person is very different. So we kind of put you in a suit or a shirt or a trouser or overcoat, whatever you want. And then after that, we see like what works for you. So we finalize all the measurements. Then depending where the fabric comes from, so we outsource a lot of fabric from Europe, some of them from Asia, from Thailand, China, anywhere. And then after that, all the manufacturing is made in China. And depending, it takes from 2.5 to 6 weeks to receive the garments. We finalize the fitting with the stylist, make sure everything is perfect. And then you have your piece of art that you're ready to wear for your big event or to go to office. Or we also do a lot of casual wears. So yeah, that's basically long story short of Sur Mesure.
Who's your client? Who are you targeting, whether that's price point, style-wise? Who are you out there trying to bring in?
So our target market is starting from really young professional. We have a lot of, I think that's a very, very strong point of Sur Mesure is we have all the price points. So the guy that gets into graduation from my school, we just allow them from CEOs that wants to pay like $4,000 or $5,000 for their suits. The answer is yes, we can do it. It's all based on the fabric. So depending on what the customer wants, do you travel a lot? Do you sweat a lot? Do you like want something like completely like with a color that's extremely bold? Or we do a lot of artists. So these guys want something flashy sometimes. So it's all based on the fabric. So that's really considering that's going to set the price point. So the answer is everyone could be our target market. And that's the beauty of it. When we started, we want to say yes to everyone. And that kind of remain our DNA of Sur Mesure.
Yeah. Looking at your website, I mean, you're talking about prices starting for suits or really nice jackets in the hundreds, the high hundreds. You're not talking about thousands. So there is a price point for an awful lot of different people. And it's interesting because there have been, and you know, there was a number of traveling Hong Kong tailors that came to Montreal or still come to Montreal. Are these the guys you're competing against when you're talking about Sur Mesure, or are you competing more against local market?
It's actually really interesting because the idea came from these traveling tailors. My brother and I went to Asia and were like, wow, I can get a suit, a shirt that costs a fraction of the price. And we're like, well, I can only get this suit when I go to Bangkok or when I go to Hong Kong, or when the Hong Kong guy comes and he's there for 2 weeks and it takes 6 months. Like there is a big gap there. We're like, well, what if we were like there 365 days per year, and guys can come with a faster turnaround, kind of same price. And that's when we're like, yeah, there's definitely a place in there. So are there a competition? Yes, because they offer something similar. However, I think that our service is it's completely different, and it's far exceed what the traveling tailor can do. Your competition can also be the Simons or any department stores of Canada. However, our service, once again, is just completely different. The level of personalization, customization, and it's really like your own garment. So I think that's also this unique perspective where you come, you sit down in the stores, we have a coffee, we chat about you, we chat about who you are, why you want this garment to be made, and what makes going to make it special for you. So that really, really the experience is a strong point of Sumerzer.
Those traveling tailors did come to mind when I was looking at the product. And I have to say, you know, what they don't have that you do is organization, branding. I mean, talk about the marketing and the branding aspect, how you put yourself forward, because here you have a system you're communicating, a good web presence. That was missing in the industry for a while when you'd kind of have to go to a mall and find these guys.
Yes. I think we started this business with absolutely zero money. So we were lucky in a way that our VC from the get-go was Visa. So we loaded a credit card and we had no budget for marketing. So really our biggest marketing from the beginning was word of mouth. You have a benchmark of experience when you go to the stores. And I think what make us grow, and now we're 10 stores across Canada, we have some in the US and Mexico as well, was you come and then you select your fabric, you have, then after that, it's like the drink or the little extra that's going to make you feel welcome. Is it going to be your monogram inside your jacket? Is it going to be the measurements that you never had a shirt or suit that fits you perfectly? Is it going to be the fabric that match exactly the dress of your brides or whatever? And then you just become, you go back to your office or anywhere, you're like, and you have sparks in your eyes. You're like, wow, I just lived this incredible experience of I made this jacket, and these became our ambassadors. So our word of mouth was spreading, and this is how we were extremely successful in Montreal and Quebec and in Toronto as well. Over time, we got bigger, we got more budget in marketing, and now it's some kind of challenging for us because we get to talk to such a big audience. So how to relate to the guy who's getting dressed for prom, how to relate to the CEOs, how to relate to the young professional or the lawyers. So it's a very vast. So we have an extremely creative marketing director at Sumerzer. We're extremely lucky to have him. His name is Jean-Pierre. He's a guy who has 10,000 ideas per minute. He's genius. So yeah, over time, we had more presence online and their publicity through social media has been also a big factor of our growth over time.
The evolution of the Sumerzer, or the tailored approach is phenomenal to watch. I mean, yeah, I'm going to date myself here, and I started working, you know, in 1989 in a very traditional profession that was, you know, suit only model. And I got to tell you, to go find a tailored suit back in the 90s was going to cost you quite a bit of money. I mean, it was a very different model than what we're seeing now. And obviously, somewhere between that evolution of bringing tailored back to the masses to a certain degree, as well as shifting away from the formal suit at work into a more casual work environment. Maybe give us a little bit of what you walked through some of that period. I mean, you've been around since 2010. I'm sure you've seen some of that evolution as well.
It's extremely interesting because indeed a suit has been always expensive. But when you go, like I mentioned earlier, to Asia, you realize I can really get a suit for extremely cheap. So I think that was the shift for manufacturing from North America to Asia that made this affordable suit concept that we now have. It's the technology of these manufacturers, the amount of money that's been put into it, it's second to none. The first, like our manufacturer, what we're making is, it's a piece of art. I think it's extremely hard now to compete with the salary that they're making, with the amount of people that they have. Labor is also very challenging now in North America. So they have the technology. They, over years and years, they hire the best pattern maker across Europe, across North America, and they just develop this expertise. So slowly, everything like went there. So I think that's the big shift that happened regarding the cost that before it was extremely expensive, that this became more affordable.
Well, there's nothing quite like a tailor-made suit. Our guest is François Thériault, co-founder of Sur Mesure, and they do suits sur mesure. Really, it's quite just that simple. Organized, they've got a system in place, and it only takes a few weeks with very competitive prices. So it's really bringing that tailor-made suit feel experience, Mike, over to the mainstream in a really organized and branded way. François, having family that was in the Schmutte business on Chabanel for many years, I have to ask about the feel and the materials and manufacturing, which we'll talk about with our BDO specialist in a little bit. Tell us about the materials you use. You know, are you getting those nice wool materials and the kind of quality that that people, I guess, are demanding from something that's sur mesure?
It's very interesting because a broad range of price also comes with very, very different material. We are 100% transparent, not to give anything bad reputation on this business, but sometimes whatever is on the label or on the fabric, it's not actually what it is. And for us, it was a key important element to what we're doing to be fully transparent. So do we have polyester suit? The answer is yes. Do we have polyester and wool blend? The answer is yes. And what we go through with a customer is really the pros and cons of each fabric. And for us, it's crucial. Some of the most expensive fabric are extremely delicate. So if you go to like some Italian wool, 180s of tread per count, it's not going to be your resistant, like hard traveling suit. However, the feel of the fabric and the shine of the fabric might be the best that you've seen it in. And we really go through a vast questioning with our customers. And if you're only going to wear one time and you don't want to spend a lot of money, we're going to direct you to the proper fabric. And that has been also the one key element of success of swimmers is transparency and also education. What is a wool from Britain, or what is this chemical that is put in the wool that makes it wrinkle resistant, or that makes it like peel with the water? So real education, and the people decide like best, better, and great, and they just decide according to what fits their needs. So, but we do have all the biggest meals. So Zegna, Holland Sherry, Skubal, Dorme, Stelbiela, name it, we have it. And that's been a part of also our vast selection to offer the best of the best.
So I'm going to take a little bit of a shift here. I mean, obviously the business that you're in, what everybody thinks sur mesure, you think face-to-face, you think coming into a retail store. We had this little thing called COVID 4 years ago that I'm sure played into how you guys managed the business that you were doing. And were there any tricks, any things that you kind of, you know, had to make changes to in order to A, survive, or B, just to bridge a gap while people were not coming to the store?
Fundamentally, my brother and I, we are people that constantly think about business. This is why we have Sur Mesure. We also have a software business, which is a spin-off of our technology that we create over time with Sur Mesure. We also have a fabric business that we distribute all our competition. We sit down in restaurants, we look at the lights, and we analyze the business model of this restaurant. We go to some place in vacation, and then we're like, oh, should we have done this? And it's just in your DNA and how we see things. When COVID hit, you have to understand for us, it was probably the worst moment that can happen. Our business, 60% of our business is made from March till June, July, because we're heavy on wedding, we're heavy on graduation, and this is where people are buying suits. It's very cyclic business that we're in. And March, usually this is where we're stretched financially and where we kind of come to see the lights. And at that point, we're about to collapse. We have an office in China, and they've been making masks for a long time. So we had access to masks. So overnight, we decide to reach the government. We send them emails left and right, and they get back to us like, yeah, they're interested. So overnight, we had to survive our business. We had to fire every single one of our company. That was probably one of the hardest thing to do, to send to Zoom or send by emails to say goodbye to people that you love, but we had to do it to survive. And then we became one of the biggest importer of mask gown for Quebec. So it was about maybe 400 million masks that we import. We had the Antonov, we had like flight coming in and out of China every other days. The story is just incredible. We wrote a book about it for kids, but can also buy at any library. But it was high stress. Every day there was something that was not working. Every day we had to figure out how to ship millions and millions of masks to the challenge of all the airport. There were some good news, some bad news, but at the end, that's how we survive the COVID and makes us bring some cash to keep the company afloat and also grow after.
It's an incredible story. Tell us, please, the name of the book.
Made to Deliver.
Incredible. And
yes, have it. It's at Renaud Barré, and also you can buy it on Amazon.
So usually we talk to people about their pandemic pivot. Obviously, yours was just significant and challenging. What are the lessons that you retained from that? And what advice would you give to people who may be in the process of still making their pandemic pivot?
You know, it's really interesting because it was all about the connection that we made over time in China. There's a saying that say you better know someone than something. And I think for us, that was actually my driver and one of the guy that, you know, always sing karaoke that hook us up with the mask manufacturer. So knowing someone, connect with people, you never know where it's going to go. And also don't be afraid and take risks, take chance. We didn't know anything about business, about the mask and all the PPE, but we took the chance and then we're like, let's figure it out from there. So something as an entrepreneur, if you think and you don't act, take action is the key. Really, I want to repeat that again, because that's a major factor of success of entrepreneurs, to take action. Just stop talking and do something. And then over time, you never know what's going to lead. So these are two points.
Yes, my favorite, execution, which I think for many businesses is where they fall down at the end of the day, you know, but willing to get things done and also willing to go, okay, this didn't work. Now, how do we pivot and change going forward? So it's that's a key. Is there anything that one particular thing that you learned out of that exercise going forward that you'd say, hey, you know, this was thanks to what we lived through COVID? And conversely, is there anything you said, oh boy, this is what we learned that we will never do again?
I learned I could manage to live with barely 1 hour of sleep for a couple days/week. So that was a one thing. Also the stress factor, sometime when everything is on the line, you can make things incredible. The attitude that you have with your company, with your organization is also key. We had this mindset where bad news were the most welcome possible. So we kind of create this climate of like, we're sharing the bad news of the day. So like, okay, like the custom, they're blocking everything. And I think like in business, you always have challenge, you always have difficulties. There's always something happening in your recession or something blocking new competition. And I think you have to embrace challenge in everything you do, and the solution factor and mindset that you have to build and create in your organization is key, and it makes it fun for people to not hide what's wrong is happening, and you can share freely what's happening and find a solution faster.
It's amazing to see how people who can manage the stress and the difficult times versus those that get handcuffed, right? Those that just can't make a decision, and how difficult it is to succeed when you just can't handle, and I don't want to say can't handle the pressure, but, you know, that ability to think clearly through negativity, because I don't think any entrepreneur is ever going to go through a situation where it's always rosy and it's always positive.
Yeah, I really agree with you.
And just a little bit of overtime now with François on Sur Mesure. Talk about the customer service experience a bit, François. You know, I remember going to see some of those tailor-made suit guys at the mall, and they're very friendly, and they have the time to pay attention to you and all of that. And how do you try to replicate that, especially, at scale?
Our business model is we're extremely lucky because we can talk to a customer for a long time. Sometimes it's hard when you go to a Best Buy or something like that. You want to be in and out to buy a TV, or your experience is very different. And the thing that's been one of our strengths is also get to know our client. And once you really create this one-on-one connection, once you create this special, everybody wants to feel unique. And Vince, my brother and I, we start working in a restaurant when we were young, and we're the two waiter that you come and they know, like, hey, good morning, John, well, how you doing? And it's going to bring you your coffee, and then exactly with two sugar, two cream, is going to bring you the sausage and the two eggs sunny side up without you say a word. And you're always going to go there because they make you feel special. And I think in this world now, everything is more digitalized. It's, everybody's ordering online, and we're really lacking this lack of touch. And for me, I just extremely enjoy like this wow factor that we create a Simmerzer, and that makes you feel special. That's one of the things really that I enjoyed the most whenever I was on the floor when I started business with my brother, was, you know, get to know the customers. And I think we create this company vision where, and really our experience is geared towards getting to know the customers and having a friend, and that's it. So
that personal experience, especially for younger millennials, Gen Z, is pretty important. What are your plans digitally down the road, on the website, app wise, and how do you plan on personalizing that experience for those who might be at a distance?
This is extremely interesting because we spend, I don't know how much in your website, from the beginning. Everybody was telling us, I want to buy a shirt online. Can I sit in my living room and create this shirt? And we spend so much money into building this 3D rendering and all this gadget. And at the end, it wasn't working. Our sale were not there, and the return investment were just terrible. I think for any business, sometimes, yes, it's great to be online, but if your one-on-one is really so strong and people want to come back, and to be honest, if you're going to spend a few hundred and on suits or on shirts, you want to make sure that you fill the fabric. You want to make sure that, you know, it's the right decision. If you have 20 cuff, 50 colors, your monogram, there's like three blue different, what's going to be the best? People end up coming to the stores, and we realize over time that, you know, it was an overkill, and our like online experience was not the greatest. So from the beginning, we were brick and mortar, really, and that was our strength. And we try online, it wasn't successful. So it's not because, you know, they say be online. It works for us. It was not successful.
So at 5'4" and change, 56 years old with a post athletic body, and I do say you emphasize the word post. Just south of two bills, there ain't anything that I can order in my living room that's going to fit properly. So I totally get that model. Quick question for you. Let's pivot to supply chain. I mean, supply chain is a huge issue right now in the world, whether that is from sustainability, whether it's the choice of China post-COVID, whether it is who the suppliers are and their trade practices. How do you go about selecting suppliers, and how do you, I guess, how do you vet so that you're ahead of whatever not always good news comes out on supply chain?
I want to start by talking a little bit about B Corp. For us, we've been trying to be B Corp for the past 3 years. It's extremely hard to get certified in the industry that we are, since all the waste and all the industry is so toxic for an environment. But we're almost there. We're probably going to get it in the next month or two. So we're ready to resubmit. But it's been really in our DNA to do good for an environment and do what's right for as a company. So we've been looking for every single manufacturer. One thing that is really, really good about Surmizer is we don't overproduce. It's one at a time. There's no two sizes alike, and there's not 10,000 that's getting thrown away or sent in the ocean and gun knows where after. So that's one thing that I love about Surmizer. The traceability of fabric has also been an issue. So for us, it's become one of the first few questions that we ask the suppliers: where your wool come from? Where's the manufacturer come from? Which kind of water are you using to treat the fabric? And also, I think slowly there's a shift in environment. I think as a retailer, we have we need to ask our supplier to these questions. So there's a shift that's getting made over time, and I think for us it's very important. And we love to explain to the customers, select this wool, and we know the traceability, where the sheep come from, and it's eco friendly or it's been certified with some eco wool. So it's sad because this industry is the one that pollutes one of the most in the world. But as a company, we really, really, really stress on finding the right supplier that they are ethically correct from top to bottom.
Yeah, I know Bill C-211 has become kind of a discussion point in Canada since the Liberal government brought it in recently. And I know, Youssef, we'll get to that in a few moments in terms of the whole discussion on the supply chain. I'd like to finish on a positive kind of timely issue. It's hockey playoff time. The cherry blossoms are going to start somewhere, and certainly not in Montreal, but they're going to be blooming. And I understand you guys have a contract with is it the hockey coaches, the NHL coaches?
Yeah, with the association, the hockey coach. We have a location in Pittsburgh, and it happens that some of the head of the garment was walking through a store. It's like, well, this is fantastic. And next thing we know, since we have a lot of stores in Canada and East Coast, West Coast, we were a perfect fit for them. So it's been a fantastic collaboration with them. So now we dress all the coach in NHLPA. It's been a fantastic partnership even for them. And also, like, it brought a lot of business, brought a lot of players to different from different market to or different location. So yeah, we're coming from Canada. We're big hockey guys. We also have the Steelers, which has been really a big brand ambassador from football. But, you know, we have a sweet spot for the hockey. And seeing them dress well on the sideline for us, it's a big happy feeling for us.
Well, congrats on your success. And Francois, we'll have your one piece of advice for inspiring entrepreneurs coming up in a few minutes. But first, let's check in with our BDO specialist. Speaking of manufacturing, Youssef Boutros is here, Partner Assurance and BDO Canada, with some advice on manufacturing and how to set up a manufacturing business. Youssef, welcome to Inspiring Entrepreneurs.
Thank you very much, Dan, for having me today.
And Mike, so many options. I mean, you can set up something domestically. You can partner with those abroad. A lot to go over.
A lot of things to consider. I mean, the difficult component to all of this is your initial selection. And I think, Youssef, I think that's probably, you know, what I'd ask you first is, you know, what are some of the key elements to consider when you're starting a manufacturing business, or you're even considering to start a manufacturing business?
Yes, exactly. So it's a good question, actually, Mike. So first of all, you know, in any type of business, if you want to start something, because you have an idea in your mind and you have some expertise. So the first question to ask is, are you going to start a new business, or you want to buy a business that have, you know, the same idea that you have? So this is the first question to ask. Sometimes, you know, we ignore this portion because there's some businesses that are for sale, especially in Quebec now with the relève and other things that's going in the market. I think there might be some businesses that are ready to be to be sold, and there's no the lev or management buyout at this level. So
I'm just going to stop you there for a second though. But if I'm considering acquiring something, where do I go? What do I look at? I mean, it's a very daunting statement. I mean, I'm not just going to Google manufacturing businesses for sale in Quebec, or am I?
Yeah. Well, you could, the web today has like tons of information. For sure, it's not the same as buying a house. You're not going to find, all what you're looking at in the web. But there is some of the sources that you can go to. There is some, the first maybe option you would have, ask your accountant if you have an accountant, because the accountants usually have, let's say at BDO, we have, a division that's called the M&A, and they have like pipelines of companies that they might be open to sell. And then once you have this first step, or even you can go to some resources online. I know in some regions, there is local organization or association that they have this type of services. And I know that the not necessarily governmental, association, but local, let's say Chamber of Commerce, or let's say in some regions, there is some association that can help out, or they can have businesses for sale. But again, maybe you're not going to find it right away, but it's very important to do this first study to see, okay, because this is going to help you. We have an idea, but you don't know if somebody else has the same idea. If who are our competitors? Am I going to compete, against these manufacturers? So the first, let's say homework that you need to do when you have this idea is to see who are our competitors, to build a business plan based on what you want to do. And in your business plan, so you want to see, okay, so what's the product? I have a product in mind. Is it like a product? Am I a retail or am I a wholesaler? What I'm going to do with this product? This is the first thing. Do I have the expertise? So you have the expertise. Maybe, usually are you an engineer? Are you a financial person? It depends on your background. I think you need also to think about this portion. How much expertise do I need to go into a manufacturing business?
Some people make the mistake of creating a manufacturing environment location-wise based on where they actually want to have the location, as opposed to strategically placing it where the labor component is or where the expertise is. Any words of advice for somebody looking at starting something up and certainly in a labor market that we're in?
For manufacturing, there's a big challenge on the labor. So let's say if we look at the big companies, I don't want to name it there, but if you design your product, you can do everything, and you can manufacturing in China, let's say. So the first thing to look at is, what's my product? Is it less expensive to do the manufacturing in Quebec or in Canada, or should I do part of the process here and do the manufacturing abroad? So this is very important. The location is important, but nowadays with the global, what we see is sometimes it's easier or it's faster to do it outside, and your margin and your cost, you have to do a certain study in that perspective. So what do I need? How much is going to cost me? Sometimes we look at all these without necessarily doing like a in-depth analysis. We need to put that all into this business plan that I spoke about at the beginning. We have to see what's going on and how much am I able to sell my product and how much it's going to cost me. Because if it's going to cost me, if I go to, I don't know, any platform online and I see this product is sold at, $10 and it's going to cost me $12 to do it, either I'm not going to go into this business, or I'm going to find a way to reduce my cost to be able to sell it at $10. So this is where I should look at the location. I should look at many, many other factors that should be taken into consideration.
I got a good chuckle before when our guest talked about how their initial financier was Visa, and I think a lot of people have bootstrapped startups in similar fashions. Once the business is up and running, what are some of the things that an entrepreneur needs to now get to the next level and help them grow the business?
Well, for sure, it's again, you need some initial investment at the beginning, but once you start the business and the business is going good, there is certain programs that some banks have, let's say in financing. Let's say you're manufacturing and you need machinery. If you want to finance, you know, you want to grow, you want more machines to produce your product. So you can use some resources in terms of, you know, certain banks or certain programs that the government can, the Quebec government has certain programs for Investissement Quebec and other type of organization that can help you out. This is the financing part. And there is some also some tax credit and other programs that can be taken into consideration. Let's say the standard R&D program, which is very important, that like there's a big portion of the manufacturing to claim their R&D claim and get this financing from the government in order to survive. And there can be other resources as well. But the most important thing is to make sure that we have the right structure in place to go to our next level. We don't want to grow very fast without necessarily having a good structure that can be sustainable at the short and long term.
Isip Boutros from BDO Canada, Partner Assurance on Manufacturing, with some timely advice there. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Dan. Thank you, Mike.
And don't forget, you can read more thought leadership and expert advice from the BDO team at bdo.ca. And as we come to the end of our show, let's turn to our entrepreneur, François Thériault of Sur Mesure, and ask him for his one piece of advice for inspiring entrepreneurs. François, what do you think?
I'm going to start with something extremely quirky that you probably always think that is silly to spend some time at the beginning. You have 10,000 things to do as an entrepreneur, but it's about vision. You have to nail your vision when you start. It's going to help you with your staff. If you have a clear, like, wow, like, yeah, this is where this company is going. This is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to achieve. The power that's going to bring to attract talent, especially now, it's so hard. It's going to be very, very good. Second, it's with your investors. Having a strong vision, it's going to really help to attract investors if you ever need to raise some money. Third one, it's going to help you through like the ups and downs, like when you have difficult decision to make. Really having this clear vision that this is where we're going to do. And over time, yes, it's going to change and adapt according to where your business are, but really come back to the core of your vision. So spend some time and really makes it the story of your vision important for you and everyone's in your business.
François Thériault, Sur Mesure, thanks so much for joining us this time on Inspiring Entrepreneurs.
Thank you so much for having me.
And a reminder, you can subscribe to the show as a podcast on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple, or your favorite platform. And next week will be our season finale. We have Ricardo Larrivée, Ricardo from Ricardo Media and IGA in pretty much every Quebecer's kitchen. He'll be joining us on the big finale next week. Thanks, Mike. See you next week.
Thanks, Dan.
This has been a production of TNKR Media. Good talk.